You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Albert Woodfox alone endured 44 years in solitary, the longest time anyone in this country has been held. Their case and unjust treatment became known worldwide and garnered the support of leaders and international human rights organizations around the world. Today, their victory is evidenced in the very fact that they are not only here with us, but they are here as fully woke individuals engaged in continuing to advocate for prison reform and providing a voice to the voiceless and those wrongfully imprisoned. Thanks to their tireless advocacy, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has since instituted a maximum amount of time a person is legally allowed to be held in solitary confinement. This is the first in the nation, but there is still so much to be done. Their struggle, our struggle, is strengthened by the countless supporters and advocates worldwide who have also dedicated their lives to advancing equality and justice. A big thank you to Marina Drummer, artist Rigo 23, and the Main Museum in downtown LA for their support of this program. Thank you also to PM Press, Robert King's publisher, and our friends at the UCLA Prison Education Program and their supporters in the community. We also acknowledge the family members of other political prisoners who don't give up hope. On the heels of the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, we gather tonight for a mere 90 minutes of time together to hear and learn the story of Dr. Robert King and Albert Woodfox. A 90-minute moment that pales in comparison to the nearly 60 million minutes the three members of the Angola Three collectively spent in solitary confinement. Clearly, there is so much more time needed to really hear such a story, but at least we have the opportunity to get started. After the conversation portion, there will be an audience Q&A. Please wait for a microphone to arrive to you if you have a question, and then please join all of our guests in the lobby for a book signing. You can learn more about their story through the books available for sale in the lobby, compliments of our library store. Robert King's autobiography is titled From the Bottom of the Heap, The Autobiography of Black Panther Robert Hillary King. We're also available is Panthers in the Hole, a comic novel published in English by Phony Media and translated by Olivia Taylor Smith, who's in the audience tonight, and Breon Baines' The Ugly Side of Beautiful. And also stay tuned, because next year, Albert Woodfox's memoir will be published by Grove Atlantic. And also, as a little extra sweet deal tonight, thank you to Robert King. If you purchase a copy of his book, you'll get to sample, while supplies last, his handmade praline candy known as Free Lines, a recipe developed in prison that he continues to make today. And if you don't have a chance to get it here, you can find it on his website. Breon Baines will be moderating tonight's conversation with Albert and Robert, and is the director of UCLA's Prison Education Program. He's traveled the nation also, touring his multimedia production, Lyrics from Lockdown, executive produced by Harry Belafonte, which tells his own story of his wrongful imprisonment. Baines is celebrated as a poet laureate of the hip-hop generation, and Cornel West has called him, quote, one of the leading minds of his generation. Baines speaks his truth with a power we desperately need to hear. More bio information on all of our guests can be found on the Aloud website. But without further ado, please welcome Dr. Robert King, Albert Woodfox, and Breon Baines to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Good evening. Peace, family. How y'all feeling? Okay. We want to first start off just by acknowledging that we are native land. We are walking on land that the indigenous people, the Tongva Nation, was on here for a very long time before any of us, most of us in this room, and our ancestors arrived. So I want to acknowledge them, their sacrifice, their struggle, their struggle against conquest and genocide, slavery. We see their struggle as our struggle, and we acknowledge them and their energy, and we call it forth into the room today. So we're going to go ahead and get started. It is an honor and a privilege to be here with you two brothers. I see you as our freedom fighters, our heroes, and I know we have so much to learn from you. Hashtag real Black Panthers. And I want to start off by talking just a little bit about your roots. You know, Brother Malcolm said, a tree without roots cannot grow. You know, and as one of the leading architects of what ultimately became the Black Panther Party in terms of his views on freedom and self-determination, I think it would be great to have an opportunity to hear a little bit about your life even before Angola. We're going to get to Angola. But the roots, before Angola, what are your earliest memories?
You know, my earliest memory as a child was, you know, my stepdad was in the Navy and, you know, traveling a lot. Wherever he would be stationed, you know, the whole family would have to go. And, you know, I remember those long car rides, you know. And I think, you know, it's so many memories, but I think that was the most impact, you know, traveling from one state to another.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. And yes, to get into it, my earliest memory, I have quite a few when I was a youngster. I remembered a lot of things. I think I started remembering when I was about 3.5, 4 years old. I think one of my earliest memories was I was living in Louisiana. At the time, I lived with my grandmother. I hadn't moved to New Orleans at the time. And I do remember I was living in a area that was low. We used to call it the Allen Highway at the time, which probably turned into I-10 at some point later in the future. But we lived on the other side of the highway, which was the low side. I think I mentioned it in my book. Mm-hmm. We lived on the low side. I think some of the earliest memory that I had was living in that house, which was unpainted, old, dilapidated. And sometime I was cold. We were cold. During the wintertime, there were bitter coldness, and even though, well, Louisiana was a place that did not get frigid weather, you know, to any great degree, being a young individual, 35, 40 degree weather, it was cold when you didn't have heat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we used wood, you know, as a means of fuel. So those were the earliest years. And mm-hmm. I remember, and I had quite a few of those days, and but they shaped my eventual evolvement. Mm-hmm. That's the way I like to look at it.
You write a lot in the book about formative experiences, key figures, and I know that your time in Angola helped to transform you in ways that have impacted you ever since because of a number of incidents that happened. But even before your arrival there, who were the people in your life who meant the most to you? Who were the people that meant the most to you, and what were experiences that stayed with you throughout your time inside?
That was me. I'm sure everybody had this type of experience. I had this love-hate relationship with my mom, you know. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I grew into the wisdom and the knowledge that she was trying to give me, and I once saw it as her trying to control my life. Mm-hmm. You know, but I would have to say my mom was probably the greatest impact in my life, and I'm fortunate enough I grew into the wisdom that she had, you know.
Okay. It's hot in here under these lights. I got to. All right. Sound, folks. Pardon me one moment. This is going to happen. All right. Okay. So, and Brother Robert,
My grandmother was my mother.
Right.
Alice King. She was my mother. And so it was she who kind of, you know, guided my thoughts. She was the person that raised me. And I did not meet my father until after my formative years, I think. I was 12 years old when I met my father for the first time. And we didn't have much of a relationship like Al, but I imagine it was my father who I had at one time a love-hate relationship with. And it took me longer to really love him when I was able to put him in context, contextualize him, and understood why he acted the way he did. It was then that I developed a sense of awareness as to why he was like that, and I was able to sort of forgive him for some of the things that he did not do with regards to myself.
And so we talked a little bit earlier about experiences that transform you, and we're talking about Sonia Sanchez, the poet, and how she said when she first heard Brother Malcolm speak, it was like you're sleeping in bed and the sunlight came into the window and you can get up and close the blinds, but you've been woke, right? You're up. You can't go back to sleep in the same way. Was there a moment for you, and I know some of this can happen incrementally, but was there a particular moment or moments for you that opened your consciousness and helped you to realize that the condition you were in was something that was linked to broader systems and broader structures and broader histories of oppression that you understand now in a way you didn't before?
Well, for me, sadly, I as I got older and I began to self-educate myself and develop a little insight and a little wisdom, I realized that, I was a petty criminal. I was a predator upon my own community. And, I brought so much pain and suffering to the people that I should have been trying to uplift and protect. And, I escaped. I was in prison. I escaped, and I went to New York. And while I had a peripheral awareness of the Black Panther Party, I got a chance to see the Black Panther Party up and close in Harlem, New York, and got a chance to talk to mostly the sisters in the party, and...
It was a different Harlem then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very different, yeah. And, you have to be African-American to understand what I'm about to see. I had always detected fear in African-American people. Because I didn't understand why, but it was there. And I can remember times, particularly my mom and I were standing at the bus stop. I was about 12, 13 years old. And the police crews would come down. And as they got closer, she kind of took me and pushed me behind her. Mm-hmm. As if she saw this threat, and she was trying to take her body and shield me and protect me, But seeing the Black Panther Party for the first time in my life, I saw black men and women without fear, I saw them being bold and aggressive and protective, of the community. I saw them escorting senior citizens to, the grocery store and stuff, stuff like it there, so that made, a real impact on me. And later on, I was on the run. I had been a captain. I was in jail. And the Panther 21, as it was known at that time, was involved with the shootout with the police. And four of the brothers came on the chair I was on. And they would hold political classes every day, you know. And you know, as I said earlier, you know, while I was listening to what they were saying, I wasn't hearing what they were saying. And another guy who was in prison doing 25 to life came now on a writ he was filed trying to get out. And he had a book with him called A Different Drummer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he told me, you should read this book. I think you'll enjoy it. And I, for the first time in my life, I picked the book up and read it from front to back and without putting it down. And all of a sudden, the thing that I had been listening to, I started hearing. And so that was kind of like the awakening of the man you see sitting here tonight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Brother Robert, I finished your book yesterday, so it's all fresh in my mind. I couldn't put it down. And you talked about a couple of moments that had a big impact on you, but losing a loved one in particular was a moment that you mentioned. I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling us if that or another moment had a significant impact in just your coming to consciousness and your decision to be involved with the Black Panther Party.
Yes, there was a lot of things that you know caused my eventual and gradual consciousness awareness. A lot of things that happened in my life, and it was initially the struggle that my mom or grandmother had. Mm-hmm. But you know, being a post, you know, World War II baby growing up in the South, Jim Crow was really everywhere. So, you know, my consciousness and my learning was incremental again, and the window kind of gradually opened. But once the window started opening, whoa! I began to see so many things. And this was even before, of course, the Black Panther Party coming into knowledge, knowledge of their existence. They put the icing on the cake, but prior to coming in contact with the Black Panther Party, there were a lot of things. Our thoughts, and I imagine our thoughts were similar, and this probably the reason why I attached myself to the doctrine of the Black Panther Party, because they were saying things and articulating things that I only felt and thought. And, you know, when they said we want freedom, power to determine our destiny, it dawned on me that we didn't have power to determine our destiny. We want an immediate end to police brutality in the community. Well, I had grew up and seen this even before the Black Panther Party was able to articulate this, because they came years later. But I saw it in the raw in the 50s, you know. But with my eventual coming into contact with members of the Black Panther Party, and I love the 10-point program, you know, we want, and like I said, we want immediate to police brutality. We want, you know, they want the right to vote, wanted the right, you know, to be men, to be women, to be productive citizens in a society. See, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace as our major political objective, but United Nations supervised plebiscite to be held in the community in which Black colonial subjects would be allowed to participate for the purpose of determining the will of Black people. Because prior to that time, you know, in my knowledge, there weren't anything of any power given to us, you know, to really articulate and to put our will out here into society, put the things that we knew out here into society to give something to society, to make society better. But it was, like I say, they put the icing on the cake. Because, and then I began to read. Once I began to see things before I came in contact with the Black Panther Party, I went to school. I only completed the eighth grade. I was so bored with school. I only completed the eighth grade. The thing that I eventually learned, they were not in school, not the school that I went to. I didn't know anything about Richard Wright. didn't know anything about Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner. I didn't know anything about these people. Mm-hmm. This was something that wasn't, you know, taught in school. And after coming in contact with those people, coming in contact with their work, my involvement just became much gradual. It just exploded. And when I really saw that wind of consciousness, you know, began to open up, and I began to embrace it. And when the Panther came along, and Malcolm X said it before them, but I didn't hear it until the Black Panther Party said it. Mm-hmm. When the Black Panther Party said it, I heard it and I felt it, and I grasped it. I held on to it because I definitely wanted an immediate end to police brutality mm-hmm. in the community. You know, I wanted justice mm-hmm. for Black people, mm-hmm. and so I embraced, you know, totally the struggle. I embraced many aspects of the struggle, but mm-hmm. the struggle for self-determination and the struggle for equality is the thing that attracted me, and I understood that it was politics that was a culprit. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the classroom to the community to the correctional facilities, there's a whole new generation of folks that are calling on the very same principles mm-hmm. that you championed for so long. And so I want to just acknowledge that. Any of y'all here, any of our abolitionists, revolutionaries, activists, organizers, anybody here fit that description? Justice Work Group, Narratives of Freedom, Beyond the Bars. Okay, that's who we're talking to. So just so we're clear on that. I want to shift gears a little bit and just talk a little bit about your first impressions when you arrived in Angola. And I want to just, by way of getting into that, share a little bit of information. We know Angola is named for the Southwest African nation, seventh largest country in Africa, where enslaved Africans were taken to work the fields. We know that we should put Louisiana into context as well. So Louisiana is the state with the highest incarceration rate in the nation. LA is the city with the highest incarceration rate in the nation. So we want to make that connection. One out of every 55 adults in Louisiana is incarcerated. Over 67% of the prison population in Louisiana is black. So the racial breakdown of its prisons are the inverse of the state population. The average age of a person incarcerated in Angola prison is 42 years old. You spent
44 years. 10 months in solitary confinement because of my membership in the party and my political belief and activities within the prison.
Okay. I'm just trying to wrap my mind around that. I just turned 43, you know? So, you know, please silence your cell phones. Okay. So I have to ask, you know, I know so many folks are probably wondering, like, what do you find within yourself? What are the lessons? You know, there's certainly more than you can get into in the time we have here. But I have to ask, are there any lessons? There's so many folks here dealing with trauma in their lives in different ways. Trauma that, you know, will not look, smell, act like the trauma you've experienced. But were there lessons, were there jewels, were there words of wisdom that were passed on to you throughout your experience that someone else might be able to draw on for them to actually understand and get through the trauma that they're experiencing, they're dealing with? That's a big question, but it's on my heart.
Fight. You fight.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You're gonna run into obstacles in life, and they're gonna overwhelm you. And if you allow it, they will rob you of your hope. They will destroy your self-confidence. They will destroy your sense of self worth. That's what, you know, America has been about, especially with its African American and other minority population. And so, you know, I was determined to define myself and not let the walls of the prison define who I would be. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, my experience with the party, you know, is the same in a lot of ways is rival, but in some ways it's different. To me, the Black Panther Party represented, you know, when they allowed me to join, here you got a young African-American man, got a 50-year prison sentence, and in prison. But I was good enough for the Black Panther Party. And for the first time, you know, outside of my immediate family, I felt that I was worth something. I had a value. And under the most horrible conditions. But still, I was saying, okay, well, we know what you did. We know where you're at. But we're going to show you a better way. You know, and it's only now, some 50-something years later, that the true meaning of the Black Panther Party is beginning to become known to the American people. You know, all of the carefully crafted lies by the American government and the FBI and other police agencies in the country. I'm so sad that it's taken so long. But, you know, people begin to see the Panthers in a different, Black Panther Party is in a different light now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that time is definitely coming in. The realization that this was a penitentiary built where four plantations, slave plantations, were put together and existed as plantations until the end of the so-called emancipation happened, right? We know the hoax that the 13th Amendment was, which because it didn't actually abolish slavery, right? It just, except for, as a punishment for crime. So when did that realization come to you that this was a part of that system? Is there a particular experience when you arrived at Angola that began to open you to that reality and to the Panthers?
Well, like I said, when I first went to prison, the Panthers, you know, weren't in existence, mm-hmm. Not during the time when I first entered prison, but in joining the Panthers, I also didn't just join an organization; I joined a struggle, and that struggle is ongoing, organization or not. Mm-hmm. The concept you can't kill an ideology. You can't destroy an ideology. Of course, we know they devastated the Panthers, you know, Jagger Hoover, COINTELPRO. In doing that, they stopped an organization, but they didn't stop the struggle. Because what you see now, you know, in every succeeding effort by anyone, black or white, you can attribute their mindset to a degree to some of the efforts of the Black Panther Party. When they first brought me to Angola, and that was prior to the existence of the party, and even though I was not politically aware, I knew something was wrong. Mm-hmm. I went into a prison at the time. You said now it's 60-some percent. I went into a prison in Angola. When I first went to Angola, it was sort of like 94% black, mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. And there were like 5,000 prisoners, and at least 4,500 of them were black, mm-hmm. you know, or more. And you know, so, you know, I saw some things that and felt something, and I got, you know, I got my impetus, you know, from thinking. I used to love to think about my condition, and when I incorporate my thinking with what I saw, I mean, the mannerism of the white guards, and it was an all-white guarded situation. Mm-hmm. The mannerism was akin to that of what I learned to be later years as Chattel. Mm-hmm. I mean, the mannerism, they refer to people as old thing and any other kind of derogatory name, mm-hmm. that they wanted to refer to you as. And this was something that I detested. Those were my first years in Angola. And by the way, I had a two stints in Angola. I was sent to Angola. It was a robbery that was committed by two people, and they ended up sending four people to Angola. I mean, they ended up sending four people to Angola for it. And even though they had the person who had committed the robbery, when they arrested the person that committed the robbery, there were three other black men with this, at least four others. And they ended up, I was at the time, I just turned 18, and they came, I didn't know anything about law, ignorant of the law at the time, and they scared the death out of us, saying that you would get 30 years in prison. I wasn't 18, and 30 years in prison, I took that literally, and they scared me to death. So we all pled guilty, despite the fact that the person who committed the robbery ended up with 7.5 years. They ended up scaring us into also pleading guilty, being ignorant of the law, saying that we would get 30 years. And as opposed to 30 years, getting 10 years and 30, of course, the rest of us pled guilty, even though we were innocent of the crime. And we ended up with 10 years in prison. And so I had a working knowledge of prison. And when they brought me to prison, I went through a lot of changes. I did. I even became so proficient. I read the Bible several times in doing that for Joseph. I read the whole 66 books, King James Version, the 39 books in the Old Testament, the 27 in the New. I was able to go from Genesis to Malachi and from Matthew to Revelation and name them in succession. I mean, I was really off into this. But I didn't stop reading the Bible. I went further. I read the Bible and I read more. Mm-hmm. And I read more. I mean, the Bible contributed. It was one of the biggest contributors to my awakening and to my evil. It was because I saw how people misinterpret the Bible. I taught it, and I read it, and I saw how people misinterpret it, sometimes deliberately. Mm-hmm. And I just felt that the thing that they were saying was just, I just disregarded that. I went on to read further. I read many other books, you know. I read books. I read folklore. I read Greek mythology, Roman mythology, African mythology. I read all the books that I could find. I just lost myself into this knowledge. I think this played a part in my evolution at this point. I don't think I'm through evolving, you know. I still got a ways to go.
Amen. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have to ask if you're, because you write really powerfully about how Christianity was part of that, how reading the Bible, reading the scriptures opens you up to a whole other world. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask if any of the Panther philosophy, obviously influenced by Marx to a certain extent, which has a very different take on religion, right? Mm-hmm. And the line most often quoted and probably seldom read is the line about the opiate of the people and religion being the opiate of the people, religion being used as a tool to oppress, to enslave, right, rather than to liberate. We know there's a whole rich tradition of liberation theology as well, with Christ of course. Revolutionary rather than Christ as submissive and gentle pacifist, afraid of confrontation. So did that come up as you began to get into the scriptures? Did that come up in as you were also becoming part of the Panthers and looking at their philosophy? Did that happen to emerge at all?
Well, I didn't become a part of the Panthers at the time that I was off into the Bible. Okay. I was released from that first charge.
Okay.
You know, and like I say, I learned more. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, I lived the Bible. I walked, talked, ate it, and slept it at the time that I did. But again, I did not stop just with reading the Bible because it was much more. And then again, if you interpret the Bible, and I don't want to go sound like I'm preaching, but a lot of people don't really understand this. Jesus said that you'll do greater things than I do. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're all of God's. And this goes back to what I was thinking earlier. You know, the mind, they say the mind is a terrible thing to waste. Mm-hmm. It's terrible to waste a mind, too. And to limit yourself to knowledge, you know, to cut yourself off with knowledge. I felt that I was cutting myself off just reading one book. I think eclectic. I mean, a lot of you get a lot of philosophers, and this is what I felt that there was a little truth in everything, and I felt that a lot of this truth had been, you know, even though disseminated with people, but it had been polluted,
right.
And I think the people had to use their mind to understand. Just, you know, the mind plays a role in your conceptualization of things that are real, things that you can achieve. You can, with the mind, like I said, a terrible thing to waste. I tell you, the only way any thought, anything that any person ever came up with, anything that they ever did, it first existed here. So there's a connection, and I think we have to understand that connection. I don't want to go to kind of philosophizing, but that's my belief.
No, we need yeah. that too. I think we need the theory and the practice. Yeah. So I think that's much appreciated. I do want to focus for a moment on solitary confinement specifically, right? And I know in 2008, Amnesty International made the Angola 3 one of their priorities, and they reported 80,000 people are held in isolation every day. They call for your release from solitary, arguing it pushes the boundaries of cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment and flies in the face of international standards to which the U.S. is a party. What evidence is there that these men are so dangerous that they must be subjected to these conditions? They have clean disciplinary histories and 4 decades of solitary confinement. There is no legitimate penal purpose for keeping these men in solitary. You know, and Brother Robert, you maintain in your book, you say, to be held guilty of a crime that one hasn't committed with exculpatory evidence to prove innocence, willfully overlooked by the courts, is an act of terrorism. Okay. So I want to bring it back to you, Brother Albert. Solitary confinement, prior to entering solitary confinement, what did you know of this? What did you know of it? Was it something that you had been introduced to in any way? What was that experience? How did that experience begin for you?
Well, you know, prior to being sent to the term in Angola, CCR, closed cell restrict, when I went to Angola, I had joined the Black Panther Party while I was in the Paris jail in New Orleans. And so, you know, I had been politicized. I had the term we use, a level of consciousness, which basically means that, you know, I didn't accept things as they were. That as when things came to me, no matter what form or shape or color or whatever, I would apply, you know, whatever wisdom I had, whatever, basically what we call a gut instinct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it didn't feel right or if it didn't sound right or smell right or whatever, you know, then, you know, I would reject it, you know. And so Harmon and I, Robert was, I think he was still in New Orleans at the time, you know. We helped establish the only recognized chapter of the Black Panther Party in a prison. And we were very active in fighting prison corruption, racism. They had a thriving sex trade going on. We formed the anti-rape squads from the guys who had joined the prison chapter of the party, in which we protected young kids, 16, 17 years old, coming into prison for being raped and being forced into sexual slavery. And which the security staff benefited from it because they gave cover and protection to the guy, the sexual predators in the prison, you know. And so, you know, it was you know, things like that. So I'll never forget April 17th, 1972, a young correctional officer was found dead in one of the units, Pine Unit. And because of the political activity that I was involved in, Harmon and some of the other people, I was the very first one that they arrested. and paraded before the entire prison population under the machine guns. Mm-hmm. That's virtually what, you know, the correction officers who brought me from the clothing room area to their dungeon. Mm-hmm. And from there, the very next day, April 18th, I was placed in CCR. CCR, for anyone who's not familiar with solitary confinement, you are housed in a 9x6 cell, 23 hours out of the day. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, it was very limited on what you could have. You could only have a Bible in your cell. You could only have so many items of clothing. You know, just enough to help you endure the hardships of being held in a small space for 23 hours out of a day. You know, they had an inmate guard system at the time. The brutality that they inflicted upon other prisoners, you know, was encouraged and sanctioned by security. I think around that time you had something like 300 people working at Angola. We should call them free men. Supervising 5,000 or more prisoners. Mm-hmm. So these inmate guards, they did a lot of the work that security people should be doing or mm-hmm. would be doing.
Overseers.
But these overseers had weapons instead mm-hmm. of whips. You know, they used to give them rifles, mm-hmm. M16s and mm-hmm. shotguns and stuff. And, you know, and they used to man the towers and the work lines and all that there. You know, they'd set up guard lines around people working in the field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so those are some of the things, you know, that we were actively resisting, you know. And eventually they brought King. And because he was a member of the party, because he knew Harmon and I, they placed him in CCR as well. Mm-hmm.
But he was 150 miles away?
Didn't matter.
I mean, how'd you magically 150 miles away snap your fingers and show up somewhere? I mean, how did they explain that?
Well, I know they explained it for about 29 years. Right. They explained it away, right. That is. The logic, it wasn't any logic to it. Like Albert said, I was 150 miles away, had never met the man in my life. They sent me to Angola 2 weeks after that incident, and they placed me in solitary confinement. They placed me first in the dungeon, and from the dungeon I was placed in solitary confinement. They placed me in close cell restriction as they had mm-hmm. placed Albert and Herman and other people whom they had picked up. And I was there, and I learned that I was under investigation, so they had me under investigation for a crime that had been committed in a prison that I was 150 miles away. I had never met a man, and I was under investigation for 29 years for that crime. Mm.
So how old were you both when you went in to solitary for the first time?
This last time.
How old were you?
I was about 22.
22?
I was about, at this particular time, about 25 or 26, maybe about 25.
Okay. All right.
And it was my second job. Right.
Yeah. Okay. And all the recent research we look at on brain development says that a person's brain is not fully developed until their mid-20s or even 30. Mm-hmm. Right, so you're at that stage of forming, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Camp J?
Camp J was a punishment program designed by the security people in Angola. Mm-hmm. Its sole purpose was to break men, break their spirits, strip away their self dignity and stuff. It was a brutal, you know. Mm-hmm. Physical force and violence was used against anyone in that program on a daily basis, hourly basis, minute basis. At some, every minute, hour, or whatever, some man in Camp J was being beaten. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the whole prison was a cesspool of violence. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those were the kind of things that we were fighting against, organizing against, educating, agitating. And as a result of that, you know, Robert did 29 years in solitary. Harmon did 41. And, you know, because of Robert's campaign, He was the first one of the 83 to be free in 2001. Mm-hmm. And he walked out the front gate. He didn't walk. He ran out the front gate. You know, but he wasn't running away from Angola. He mm-hmm. was running to anyone that would listen about mm-hmm. what was being done to mm-hmm. to Harmony and I and myself personally. But the men in being held in Angola as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so, basically it became, we were political prisoners, under the tyrant, because we were being persecuted and held in solitary confinement because of our political beliefs and our political activities. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, we were forced to endure, brutality unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And we had to witness men going insane, men who hurt themselves, cut themselves, whatever, men who actually committed suicide because they could not stand the brutality and the confinement of solitary confinement. I mean, for anyone who would love to have anything close to the experience, try staying in your bedroom, because that's about the size of most cells, size of a bedroom in a home. Try staying in there for 23 hours, So imagine what it's like to be held in that kind of situation without any hope of being able to do anything to get you out of it. The Harmon and Robert and myself, we had impeccable conduct records. It wasn't because they had broken us, it's because we were living under the principles and of the Black Panther right. Party. Right. Our values and principles and code of conduct were those that had been taught with us and demanded of us from the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a situation where the prison had broken us or they had intimidated mm-hmm. us. If anything, they just made us a thing. But I think what was more important than anything is that Robert, myself, and Harmon, instead of turning toward the prison and becoming institutionalized, we turned to society. So the values and the moral principles and the code of conduct that we developed were as a result of the impression of society, the things that was going on in society. We didn't turn inward. We didn't become institutionalized. We didn't live by the code of being, a legalized slave. Mm-hmm. That's what you are. Mm-hmm. In America, when you go to prison, you go from being a slave on a plantation to a slave of the state in a different kind of plantation, So, those are the things that, helped motivate and carry us for decades, And as I said earlier, my mom, I finally began to understand what she was trying to do, And I'm happy to say that before she passed away, I lost her to cancer, I was able to sit down and ask her forgiveness and tell her that, I hope, that she had, the things she had instilled in me had helped me become the type of man I was. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the proudest moments of my life.
You said you wrote some poetry around that too, right?
Yes.
Any chance I could get you to share a little bit of verse with the people?
Well, I had this situation where, as I said, when I eventually caught up to the wisdom of my mom, mm-hmm. I wrote a poem as a tribute to her and mothers like her,
Okay. Do you want to hear some poetry? Yeah? All right. Well, we're going to get ready to open it up in just a moment, so get your questions ready, please.
The poem is called Echoes. Echoes of wisdom I often hear, a mother's strength softly in my ears. Echoes of womanhood shining so bright. Echoes of a mother within darkest night. Echoes of wisdom on my mother's lip, too young to understand it was in a gentle kiss. Echoes of love and echoes of fear, arrogance of manhood wouldn't let me hear. Echoes of heartache I still hold close as I mourn the loss of my one true hero. Echoes from a mother's womb, heartbeat held so dear, life began with my first tears. Echoes of footsteps taken in the past, echoes of manhood standing in a looking glass. Echoes of motherhood gentle and near, echoes of a lost mother I will always hear.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. So the Angola 3 would not be the Angola 3 without Brother Herman. Would you like to share?
Of course.
On his behalf?
Yes. I don't have any poetry at the moment, you know? But I do want to share Herman's voice. Herman is always here with us, as Albert points out, even though he's gone. But people don't hear his voice or the words that came from his soul. Anyway, he writes on Saturday, August, 1981, I was transferred to LSU Hospital for evaluation. I was informed that the chemo treatments had failed and were making matters worse, and so all treatment came to an end. The oncologist advised that nothing could be done for me medically within the standard care that they are authorized to provide. They recommended that I be admitted to a hospice care to make my remaining days as comfortable as possible. I have been given 2 months to live. I want the world to know that I'm an innocent man and that Albert Woodfox is innocent as well. We are just two of thousands of wrongfully convicted prisoners held captive in the American Gulag. We mourn for the many family of Brent Miller. That was the man who was killed. And he was allegedly charged with killing a man. He extended the fact that he mourned for the family of Brent Miller and the many other victims of murder who would never be able to find closure for the loss of their loved ones due to the unjust criminal justice system in the country. We mourn for the loss of the families of those unjustly accused who suffer the loss of their loved ones as well. Only a handful of prisoners globally have withstood the duration of years of harsh and solitary confinement that Albert and myself have. The state may have stolen my life, but my spirit will continue to struggle along with Albert and the many comrades that have joined us along the way here in the belly of the beast. In 1970, I took an oath to dedicate my life as a servant of the people, and although I am down on my back, I remain at your service. I want to thank all of you, my devoted supporters, for being with me to the end. Herman Wallace.
So I think we would like to open it up for questions. I want to be very welcoming and also very clear that we are looking for questions. So if you have a comment, there'll be a book signing afterwards. If you have a question, please raise your hand.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if there was one thing that kept you going, what was it?
for me it was, and for Robert as well, it was the love of humanity. We dedicated our life to be revolutionary and social struggle. And our objective then and now is to protect and help build humanity so that at some point in time there will be no need for the economic oppression and exploitation that go on in this country. Now, there will be no need for human beings being judged on the color of their skin, ethnicity, the hair texture, or their physical features. We will, you know, I'm sorry, but I'll let Robert finish. You know.
So the question was what kept us going?
If there's one thing that kept you going, what was it?
Well, it wasn't one thing that kept us going. It was many things, and it was just as Albert pointed out, but I imagine if I was forced to single one thing out, I would have to say that it was my total rejection of a system that oppressed. It was my being politicized into learning who my enemy really was and what was my enemy. And my enemy was immersed in lies and discrepancies and hypocrisy. And the fact that I felt that this was a wrong done to mankind and society, and if I could do anything to right this wrong, you know, or to offset it in any manner, I would do so. And I made a dedication to within myself. And I didn't make a promise to anyone else, but to promise myself that in order for me to live fully and wholly, you know, and to contribute in the manner in which I want to, I have to do it the way I'm doing it now. And that is to continue to struggling.
Thank you.
I read something that said that when people are in solitary confinement for a long period, they sometimes hallucinate, and I wondered, just their brains start overacting. Did either one of you experience that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I still, even though I'm, you know, have a greater movement, I still suffer from claustrophobic attacks. It has been scientifically proved that anyone held in solitary confinement suffer brain damage and physical deterioration at a much greater speed than the normal aging process would require.
Yeah, I think I suffered, some damage. It was mostly physical. And did I hallucinate? I meditated instead of hallucinating. I meditated, and I continued to think about. I used to love to think, and I used to spend hours and hours and hours thinking, dissecting my our condition. So no, I didn't. You know, this is solitary confinement. Scientists have proved this, and we have been on panels in which I have a pill on. Albert has a pill on that. American Association of Scientists has pointed out that solitary confinement, people held for prolonged periods in solitary confinement, it can cause brain damage. I totally agree with that, and I don't have no issues with their findings. But I think there's some people who can weather the storm. I mean, people ask me a lot of time, how did we manage or how did we weather the storm? People want to know, why aren't you crazy? And I look at him, I say, wait a minute, I didn't tell you I wasn't crazy. You know, don't conclude that. I don't think anyone could get dipped in waste and not come up smelling. So, but I'm not psychotic, you know, and I don't hallucinate, you know, but I still meditate. And I'm not saying that other people don't, but no. No, that's all right.
I just got to flip the question on its head, though. It's like, how, if we are functioning in a society which is taking folks for decades at a time and putting them in the hole, right? Like, are we sane, right? That we're, because like, we're financing this, right? Your tax dollars are financing this. So the question leaving this room today is, if we actually want to preserve our collective sanity, right, in this crazy world we're living in right now, like, what can we do? What are we willing to do? What are we willing to give up? What sacrifices are we willing to make to actually move the country? Angola is the largest prison in the country, but these, LA has, California has, you know, across the country has their own versions of Angola, and we have the ability to do something about that. So I think we're ready for another question.
Being a late 70s baby, I didn't grow up experiencing the type of racism that you all did. And so now that I'm seeing all of this go on, I feel like I should do something, but I don't really know what to do. And I hear so much commentary about, well, what was done prior is not going to work now. And I just wanted to know how you feel about that being said, and what can someone like me do? Because I'm like hella angry, and I feel like I should do something. And great, I don't want to do the wrong thing, because sometimes I feel like popping off.
Excellent question. Excellent question.
Well, first of all, when you're struggling for social justice, there is no wrong thing. You know, if you're struggling for personal gratification, recognition, then you achieve nothing. You know, so you find there are others who feel like you, who think like you. They could be in your next door neighbor. They could be in the church you go to. They could be on a parent at the school where you. Kids or relatives may go to, and you have to unite with them and fight to build a better humanity, fight to build a better world, better society. You know, as King and I always try to say, individual can only create chaos. Mass movements can create change. So that's what you have to do. You have to start trying. You know, King has a very wise saying that, you know, throwing pebbles in a pond, you cause waves. And if you throw enough pebbles, waves can become a tsunami. And we all know that tsunamis changes everything. So, you know, that's what you can do. You know, first of all, believe in yourself and believe that what you're doing is right. And be willing to fight for it.
Yeah, I agree. And briefly, yeah, just add on to that, or the coattailing. Yeah, if you throw pebbles in the pond, you get ripples. Keep throwing those pebbles in the pond. Some people throw rocks, you know. Some throw pebbles, you know. Some even throw a mountain, or try to throw a mountain. You get a big splash if you throw a mountain. Like individual gratification, you may get that, and you see a lot of that. But a people's movement, moving collectively, each continuing throwing the pebbles in the pond, those pebbles, you know, those ripples become waves, and like Albert said, it becomes tsunami. People are like that. The collective movement of a people. You know, during Chattel, you know, the height of chain slavery, you know, many people believed that the struggle was confined to a certain segment of people. The Underground Railroad was, the people who were in servitude didn't have the ability to create an Underground Railroad. They needed allies. They needed help. It was when people who saw slavery, chattel slavery, as being something that was immoral and reprehensible, even though it was legal, legality and morality do not shake hands in a courthouse.
That's right.
You know, it don't. So, But it wasn't until people saw, you know, Chattel as being immoral, repugnant, that they lodged against this. And it took all people coming together, fighting to rid themselves. Of course, yeah, they created another. They halted what was going on. But in the process, because when they, you know, eliminated Chattel slavery, they immediately instituted legal slavery in a much broader sense. Because, again, you could be innocent of a crime, you know, but found legally guilty of that crime, and then you could die for that crime. So this is the reason why we have to make the distinction between legality and morality, and we have to understand this, that one individual or two individuals won't accomplish this. It's a process. It's a prolonged, it's a struggle, and it means just that. And I thank for each individual who throw a pebble in a pond and make it possible for someone else to throw a pebble in a pond to build up on that. Whatever you drop in a pond or throw in a pond, whether it's a big pond, a big pebble, a little pebble, remember this, that in whatever you do, remember, make it effective, you know, make it meaningful. Because, again, like I say, anybody could come up with a big splash and they'll instantly remember, but in actuality, they're totally forgotten. I think people coming together, you know, and having a prolonged struggle, I think that means a lot. That makes a difference.
I appreciate you all being here.
Thank you.
My question is about the privatization of prisons. That system where sometimes judges are incentivized to continue to convict. And these are private companies that are profiting versus the federal government, state or city, county governments. How do we stop that? How do we fight that? Because that is a whole nother issue where mostly people of color minorities are going into these privatized prisons and jails, and there's a price tag on their head, you know, for every phone call, for every, you know, visit, if they can even have a visit, or the video visits, et cetera. It's a cost to every single thing for that person to be in there. Thank you.
Prison, it's called a prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest private prison,
Wagon Hut Correction Corporation.
Trades on Wall Street, so that tell you, you know, private imprisonment has become one of the biggest economic institutions in this country. How do you stop it? Well, first of all, we have to start being smart with our vote. We have to. You know, we have situations where men and women are voting for people because they agree with one issue, you know. And we have to stop doing that. We have to start, you know, finding out what these people who come before us and ask us to put them in positions of power and authority to govern our lives daily, you know. We have to, you know, see this, the whole person, not, you know, that one issue that I agree with, you know. And then we put these people in the power, and then when they start doing things that hurt us individually, hurt our communities, you know, then we have the question, well, how did this happen, you know? Right now, we got a man who's the president of this country, openly a white supremacist. How did that happen?
Yes, and just to add to that, private prison, yes, is a concern. Private corporation, you know, Wagon Hut, that Albert pointed out. How do we stop the private prison? I think first we have to focus and pay more attention to state-run prison, simply because if you look at the private sector of prisoners, and Obama, while he was president, I think he kind of shut down and eliminated. All it may come back to on a federal level, it may come back. But you have to understand this, that private prisons are not the culprit, because of all the people incarcerated in America, private cooperation and those entities and sub-entities like Wackenhut and whatever they are now, they changed the name frequently, they house only 250,000 inmates, if that many. Mm-hmm. The biggest majority of prisoners are in state-run prisons. And there are some in federal, but the biggest majority. And the state-run prison is not privately-run corporation. It is run by the state. So in order to eliminate or to cut down on the proliferation of, you know, Wackenhut's, the private corporation sector, we have to focus first and foremost on the state-run prison, because these are your biggest culprit. The United States government and the federal government are your biggest private cooperation. They are your public cooperation, mm-hmm. and they house more people than any private corporation could ever house in America.
Right. Yeah. And before we go to our last question, I would just add that the state prisons, federal prisons, they also have private contracts with Starbucks. So when you get your lattes,
they do.
That's where your money's going. Victoria's Secret.
Right.
Dell Computers.
Right.
It was, for a long time, it was MCI. They got outed, right? And then they stepped out of it, right? But we got to educate ourselves, do that research. There's going to be a lot of folks in the lobby space when you leave who are doing this kind of work. So I encourage you, invite you to introduce yourself to somebody. If you see organizers handing out flyers, talk to folks, get some information, figure out what else is going on. There's a lot going on this very week, so we can continue to educate ourselves and work together and to collaborate on bringing down this oppressive system. I want to read one last quote from the book, From the Bottom of the Heap, which I recommend you get along with Panthers in a Hole. They're two really brilliant books that will help put a lot of this in perspective. And the quote that I want to read, which I think answers this question as well, says, "The Black Panther Party's slogan, 'Power to the People,' centered around the concept that power actually does belong to the people. But the people have relinquished that power to a small faction of people called politicians. And in relinquishing power, they have left themselves at the mercy of ever-changing restrictions defined as laws. Many of these laws, deemed legal, are in no way moral. In reality, we are empowered en masse to direct or redirect our own course. In redirecting our own course, one of the main focuses must be the prison system and how it is connected to slavery."
As Brother Breon mentioned earlier, California has its own gulag, which houses people in solitary confinement for decades, and especially people of color. And in 2012, there was one of the biggest hunger strikes here in California by the people in solitary confinement, which included Black, Brown, and even white supremacists who were also incarcerated in solitary confinement. So my question to you is, have you ever been in a situation in solitary confinement or in prison where you had to work with, you know, people of white race who were supremacists in order to work as a collective and get things done?
Yes. During our early years in CCR, when they placed us in CCR, I was trying to think of how many, 80, 90-some prisoners they had housed in CCR. They only had about two or three whites. Everything else in there were Black. So we didn't have the problem with, quote, white supremacy. If it did, they were self-suppressed. When they came on the till, it wasn't more white supremacy. It was just people. So that's how we sort of dealt with that. Now, over the years, like I said, when I was released from prison, I don't think there were any When I was released in 2001, I don't think there were any whites in CCR on the prison. Well, he had some whites, maybe three or four, but the majority of the people on the tour was black, and the majority of people in CCR at the time were black, you know, for many, many years, especially during those early years. So we didn't have that too much problem with white supremacists coming on the tier, disrupting, again, because whoever came on the tier that we lived on, we constructed ourselves in a manner that we felt was dignified and that was, you know, was in conjunction with the principles of the Black Panther Party and, you know, being kind to the people, teaching the people, you know, being polite. And that was our only motive. And people embraced us for that. And the couple of few whites that they had on the tier most of the time, but a few times in those early years, they embraced, if they, like I say, they embraced our philosophy at the time.
Before we go, ma'am, please stand up. Yeah, you raise your hand. Yes. Yeah, you're the very first one to raise your hand to ask a question. And before we leave tonight, I want to know what your question is.
Robert, Mr. Albert, I just
want to
say respect. But I'm curious. I'm a librarian, and I'm curious how you got your books in solitary.
Well, when we were first put in solitary, we weren't allowed to have a Bible in our cell.
Really?
Yes. And because as a result of both physical and eventually protests and struggles in the courts, we won the right to have other books. Now, the crazy thing about it is that the prison library was supplied with books from public libraries. And there was a wealth of books in the prison library that the prison administration didn't even know about. You know? So the first political book I read was called Retro the Earth by Franz Fanon. And that came out of the prison library. You know? So, you know, I remember one time someone had sent me a COINTELPRO. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't let me have it. And so I filed what's called an ARP, Administrative Remedy Procedure. It's the first step in filing a civil suit. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to challenge, you know, the censorship. Mm-hmm. And so one of the prisoners that worked in the library made a personal trip to CCR, you know, and he said, look, you know, word through the grapevine is you're getting ready to drag these people into court over a book. He said, look, I have the book. I'll give it to you. He said, hey, all I'm asking is you don't drop your suit. He said, because if you file a suit, then they're going to come in that library and they're going to, in order to try to protect themselves, they're going to come in that library and we have a treasure trove of books. Mm-hmm. You know, so I said, well, okay. You know. So I took the book and let the ARP run out, you know.
All right.
Will you please give it up to Albert Woodfox, Robert King, the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Thank you.
All right.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.